we're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here looking in the mirror.
Everybody just do your job. You understand that?
Hey, will you shut up?
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Thank you, Lee.
Fellas, I come to you exhausted. I'm at the end of my rope. I can't go any farther like this. Although I believe that we must, through at least December and perhaps January. I find the Colorado conversation, the Colorado thing, exhausting. But I will say, it's not for the reasons you might think. I'm not tired of Colorado. I don't want to see him fail. I'm not in that camp. What I find exhausting is I feel like whenever I have a conversation about Colorado, and that could be with you two, Alex Kirshner and Stephen Godfrey, that could be with a friend from home, that could be with my mom, it feels like I'm having five conversations at once whenever I'm trying to talk about them. It's extremely easy, I think, for people to move the goalposts. I say 4-8. Alex Kirshner, you say X million people watched the Colorado State game. I say,
sure.
I don't know about Shadur's first round NFL draft prospects. Stephen Godfrey, you say, but the offensive line was really bad. It's this call and response in the church of Deion Sanders. So we are going to talk about Colorado on this show because I do want to talk about Colorado and I am interested in talking about Colorado, but we're going to talk about it in at least four different ways, specific to those ways. And I will buzz you. I will buzz both of you if you try to take the conversations outside of their specific lanes. This is about, as much about, I should say, how we talk about Colorado as it is what we are talking about when we talk about Colorado. But first, home field apparel, the code SZ20 for 20% off of your first order. Their Little 500 merch over the weekend, I don't know if you saw that, Alex. The drop there was quite good. And as usual, home field has banger stuff. You are wearing the Georgia Bulldogs Light Up the Night shirt, I believe.
I am wearing the Light Up Sanford Georgia Bulldogs long sleeve tee. I'm a big proponent of the home field long sleeve tee. I think that of all of their types of wares, that might be my favorite, but you know, there's candidates. Stephen Godfrey, you're putting on for their hometown team and at home field, the Indiana Hoosiers, by the looks of it.
Yeah, I added Indiana into the like justifiable school rotation, which is a weird collection of just things that like I either actually, you know, I think I have the whole Georgia Southern line, and then I have schools that I can make a logical connection to, and then I just threw Indiana in because, you know, home field started in Indiana. What do I care? I think Bloomington's a great town. I don't have any heat or interest or partisanship in basketball. So I know when I wear, if I walk outside my office, I guarantee this, if I walk outside my office in Nashville today wearing this, I will get some sort of like very angry basketball comment, which is, I don't know. I just work for home field, man.
SZD20 for 20% off of your first order on homefieldapparel.com. Nokiantires.com/potholes. Nokian, a proud sponsor and partner of what we do here at Split Zone Duo. Go there to make your case for the worst roads in North America. I've said it multiple times on this show. I do believe the worst roads in North America might be in New York City. They are just terrible around here. Truly, truly terrible. And Substack is where you can find all of the premium content that Split Zone Duo produces. That's splitzoneduo.com. I have in the last couple weeks released two draft specials. If you're listening to this show before the draft, and by the way, if you're listening to this show after the 2024 NFL draft, it's a good time to go listen to my QB special with Derek Klassen and Ben Solak. We broke down the entire QB draft class. We did a review on last year's class. We talked a lot about this year's class. You know, there's some clarity, obviously, on the first two picks and the first two quarterbacks off the board. And then what happens with 3 and 4, we'll see about that. But we talked about the whole quarterback class. If your team is in line for a quarterback, in need for a quarterback, or got a quarterback in the first round, go and take a listen to that show. All right. That was a football conversation about professional football. Here is the football conversation about Colorado. Again, fellas, the parameters of this first conversation are about the football, the on-field product for Colorado. Stephen Godfrey, that on-field product was really cool for like 4 weeks. Then it wasn't last year. Obviously, Colorado went 4-8. I will buzz you if you talk about something other than football, but where do you stand on the football of it all at the University of Colorado?
Fun, but wildly inconsistent, ultimately not built to win as it stands. Again, like all of the obvious markers. So, you know, top end talent at skill position, essentially no depth. It's like you're trying to play the sport of football without the lines. And that's about it. I think, estimation of the football product was artificially inflated because they beat the, what do we call them? Defending runner up. In the debut game, who turned out to also not, they were not particularly good either.
Yeah.
And then they went like wire to wire with an also mediocre Colorado State team. And so I think, just on the football merits, it looks something like a pretty standard, kind of like high end G5, low end P4 season, debut season for someone who wants to run a tempo offense and do a lot of dynamic stuff, but has really no depth and didn't recruit well.
And we talk about the offense. The offense is changing. And I think the offense is changing in ways that there could be a radical shift in how this thing looks next year. Remember, Colorado last year ran, let's say, a version of the Sean Lewis offense, because how long Sean Lewis was calling said offense or that, whatever, that's a whole conversation, different conversation. But they are switching gears quite significantly. I think Pat Shurmur, former head coach of the Giants, New York Giants, and can't remember where else, it has known Dion for a long time, was on staff and is going to be the offensive coordinator this year. Pat Shurmur, by the way, actually has a pretty decent reputation in football circles as a football guy. I know that you may laugh because the Giants sucked when he was a coach, but whatever. There's some people who think pretty highly of Pat Shurmur. I think some of the offensive shift comes down to preparing Shador for the next level, to be honest with you. I think that has a pretty decent amount to do with it. And so we'll see how that plays. They obviously have Dylan Edwards at running back. They are bringing in Dallin Hayden from Ohio State in the portal, at least as a verbal commitment at this point. And so they may have a bit of a two-headed monster at running back. But Godfrey, as you made the point, the offensive line situation was very not good at a lot of different points in the season. And so I'm curious about how this works because, Alex, of where they're going, right? Like, they're going to the Big 12. Now, you may have been able to passy-passy woo-woo in the artist formerly known as the Pac-12. Can you do that week in, week out in the Big 12?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that they will probably block it up a little bit better for Shador this year. I think if we are keeping this confined for the opening to a strictly football conversation, they have done from the incoming class for the class of 2024, a little bit, a dollop of high school recruiting. They have a five-star tackle who's going to come and play for them. One of the best transfer recruits that they got was an offensive tackle, Peyton Kirkland from Texas. I suspect that they will not have possibly the worst line in the power conferences again for a second year in a row. I suspect that. I don't know that for sure. I think you make a really good point, though, about wow, this is going to be tough, again, to keep it confined just to football because it sort of gets into other things about Dion. It felt last year like it was very possible that the shape of the Colorado offense was designed to develop Shador for the NFL, sometimes at the expense of developing Colorado to win games. I think that scapegoating Sean Lewis and, you know, you have objectively one of the better, more hireable offensive coordinators in the country, and you sideline him two-thirds of the way into the season because if something's not working, it can't be the quarterback. It can't be the roster construction that you put around the quarterback. It's got to be the coordinator, I think was a reasonable interpretation that a lot of smart people took away from that. And I also think that I wasn't completely sold on this, Richard, and I'm not sure how sold on it you were, but the notion that Shadur intentionally took a great deal of sacks so as to not run up interception or sack totals, run up interception or incompletion totals, was not entirely unpersuasive to me, I should say.
Like, if you want to talk about a 4-8 team this much, like a 1-year 4-8 team, which by the way, like if you look at their schedule for 24, I would argue there's probably 8, if not 9 rosters that are just fundamentally better, like straight up. And honestly, like 5 of them are more interesting to talk about. We're doing a thought exercise here, which is why we're spending this much time on one 4-8 program. But the reality is that quarterback didn't match that offense and was not developed either. They attempted to develop him for that offensive system, which has proven to win. Or he rejected it, we don't have to dance around it. Look, the head coach's son behind the scenes didn't fit with that offensive system. It was shown. I mean, we know this empirically, right? And that essentially kind of killed the season for them, at least on offense. So this is where you can't, to break your rule, Richard, you can't just objectively talk about a 4-8 team that way in football terms.
But here, I would...
But that's by design by Dion.
I would move the goalposts within the bounds of this conversation. I would move the goalposts thusly. First of all, Alex, I don't think Shadur was sandbagging. I think it's a detriment in his game that he held the ball too long last season.
He didn't intentionally kill Sean Lewis. He just didn't understand the system.
And there were some years, in particular, like at the beginning of Lewis's run at Kent State, where they took a lot of sacks too. And so, I understand, I understand that, and I should be clear that, like, I'm not saying that the entire Colorado offense last year was like built to be flawed so that Shadur could go and have a better draft resume. But I do think it's just like a reasonable conflict of interest for Dion makes you wonder last year at some point you just got to run the damn football, Richard. Like at some point, like you can't keep your quarterback upright. Like you've got to stop taking 7-8 yard losses in chunks.
Right.
Yeah. Five times a game. And they just never did.
But the offensive line stunk. Right.
Well, it's hard to scheme around a terrible offensive line. Yeah.
And why is that?
The offensive line's stuck. I mean, but Godfrey, you, like,
and here's, why?
Here's a quick goalpost move within the bounds of the football. If the quarterback doesn't jive with the offense, does it not make sense to change the offense for Team X, not Colorado, for Team X? If you think the quarterback can't play in this offense or doesn't jive with it, you change the offense.
I think what you do in a vacuum in like a normal case study is that you try and engineer your book around your quarterback. And I think that clearly never happened for reasons that we can only speculate about. But I do know that because of the posturing in the media by the quarterback, by the father, who's the head coach, and the reputation of the OC who got run off, it leads you to believe it's going to take you to a certain belief.
My question, and this is another, again, we're staying in the football here still. My question is, if you always knew, I think everybody knew the deal with why Sean Lewis was going to be there, right? Like, I don't think anybody thought Sean Lewis was going to be there for a decade as offensive coordinator. I think
everybody didn't think he was going to be there for 6 games.
Well, that's true. we thought he'd make 12. And it's debatable whether he actually made 6, but okay. I am interested in, was the plan to always change the offense, or probably was the plan to change the offense this radically? Obviously, we haven't seen it. Like,
I think you're paying a lot of stock into the idea of there being a plan.
I think it's fair. It's a fair point. But I think if Sean Lewis was what I'm getting at is, if Sean Lewis is always going to leave in January 2024, were they just going to continue to run a version of it, or did they throw the baby out with the bathwater?
There's no way. Why are you making the assumption that it was going to be one and done? Like I know why you are.
It's, I was going to say, Sean
Lewis couldn't bridge into a better head coaching job because Kent State is it's a hard program. It's a tough resume look. And because we did a whole episode on why Mac head coaches aren't getting jobs. So he went to a high profile place at the behest of his representation. to raise his like Q rating, his CV, so he could get a job. So yes, there was a possibility he could have. But the idea, look, it's kind of a minor miracle. And I think those same representatives probably had to go back and unfuck the situation. It's a minor miracle he got a job as good as San Diego State after the way it went down for him coaching Deion Sanders' son and essentially getting benched. He got benched. They benched the OC. It's not unheard of, but it sure is kind of strange when you look at the reputation of those involved and the track record of those involved. So yeah, now I know we're bordering outside of football lines, but that decision in season, this is where you get into the criticism of Deion, which I don't know if it's like allowed for this thought experiment, where it's like, that didn't look like a Power Four head coach with experience. That looked like an AAU dad.
I suspect that they're going to be a little better on offense. I just think that the line, like it is really hard to scheme around having a terrible offensive line. And Sean Lewis did it maybe for a week or two. He did it in the TCU game and kind of when they beat Nebraska and kind of against a bad Colorado State, but that was Colorado State. Richard, I'm intrigued by the defensive situation at Colorado, which, you know, also particularly against the teams that could actually play, just wasn't even close to up to snuff. They actually have added a few players on that side of the ball who are, I think, really, really good. I don't know if it's enough. And they also lost not just Cormani McClain, who didn't actually play much last year. And we'll get to that, I'm sure. But like they did lose some guys who were actually important pieces for them going forward. I think that they will be better trench-wise on defense, though, too. They got Deion Hayes from Pitt, who I've watched a lot over the years, and who is going to be really good for them if he's still on the roster by September, which I'm guessing he will be. I expect that they will get a little bit of splashier trench play this year than they got last year. By the way, Richard, no coach has ever been as angry as I am sure Pat Narduzzi was about losing this player, Deion Hayes, to Colorado in this fashion, because this was going to be one of Pitt's best players. And he goes to Colorado. Pat and Deion already have beef. And on his way out the door, the player gives an interview where he says that I'm leaving because I don't think we're ready to win here at Pitt. And then he goes to Colorado. Now, Colorado went 4-8 last year. Pitt went 3-9. So maybe there's something to it. Maybe players believe that Deion is onto something this year.
They do.
And that Deion, the ones and that Deion, do. That's, I think there's, whoa, there's something wait, to
players
that.
Players believe that Deion is onto something?
100%.
Gotta have
players. What about all the ones that just left?
I just said the players who do. The players who buy into it.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you could say that about East Carolina.
Of course. Of course you can. I'm not quibbling with that. He has players who have bought in. I don't want to get to the certain type of player because that's outside the football conversation. But the players who buy in are buying in, clearly. But Alex,
what is the ultimate purpose of keeping it as a football conversation?
Well, because I do want to make one more point, which is to talk about the portal. Because the portal giveth here and the portal taketh away, right? That is a point here to make. There's a Dallin Hayden in. And then you look at their portal and, like he's mentioned, Cormani McClain, out. Like, it's
Paul
not
McCaskill,
like they...
It's running not, back who was supposed to be good for them from Houston. Never happened. Left. Yeah, he was last year's, as Bud Elliott, friend of the show, I said, that was last year's Louis. And it just didn't happen.
As players, like, it's not like they've just vacuumed up talent and that's it. Right, we talk a lot about the portal that they've gotten, but without the portal that has left, without the players who have left, and it's the sleight of hand that every fan makes in every program, which is the players who left can't play or, you know, don't want to be here or whatever. And this is now Shador made this point in public. He literally was like, if you're not playing here, that just means you're doing something wrong, was the direct quote that he made, which every team's fans make. Like, it just is what it is. And so I get it. So yes, the portal is giveth and the portal taketh away, Alex.
You know, so you're correlating the behavior of players and staff with fans of other programs, right?
I think that that is a thing that happens with players at other programs as well.
No, but what I'm saying is that players, so one of the things that it's too obvious not to contextualize is that these lightning rod moments that you're talking about, that that sort of Venn diagram over the different parts of this conversation at Colorado, it's because the behavior, the way that the coaches and players comport themselves is more similar to talk radio fans than it is to the their those talk radio fans as coaches and players. That's a big part of the disconnect.
I have said on the show before that if you have a quarterback transfer in spring, that is usually good because it means that somebody won the job and you have a defined leader at that position. I do not think it's good if like 20 players transfer in April and go into the portal in the spring window, which is what's happened to Colorado. Because even if that means you're just shuffling out like the bottom of your roster and it wasn't going to work out for these guys there, you only have 85 scholarship players, and there isn't that much high-end talent generally available this time of year. And so maybe not great. I would just kind of flag that as well from Colorado's perspective, that nearly a quarter of their roster, probably a little less, went into the portal in spring after getting a look at things during spring ball. Like, Deion has sold it one way as what are we losing? Not much, but it's quite a bit to decide if you're not losing anything. It's quite a bit to decide that wasn't any good on your roster this late in the offseason.
Let's venture into a different conversation about Colorado. The Deion Sanders leader of men conversation. Deion Sanders has written a book. It's called Elevate. And Dominate, 21 Ways to Win On and Off the Field. Deion Sanders has been doing a book tour of this book during the spring. He was on the Today Show. He was on CBS This Morning. He did a Q&A in the New York Times. Like, this ain't just like, this is a capital B book tour for this book. I don't know where it stands on the list of New York Times bestsellers or Amazon bestsellers, whatever, but it's a Simon & Schuster published book. It is a book with a capital B, man. It ain't like, you know, it's not as big a deal as Shutdown Full Books, but it's a little publishing house that you may have heard of. So look, you get a lot of coaches who write books. That's happened. Urban Meyer has a leadership book, for instance. Like, that's not a rarity at all.
Sure does.
But Godfrey, I would say the book tour during the spring is an interesting strategy. And I also like Deion Sanders, motivational speaker. He talks in allegories. He talks in
pablum.
He talks in mini sermon. You know what I mean? Like
bullshit.
By far, but not close to the only college football coach who does it, Sweeney Kamadabo. Like, but it's impossible to ignore. And the more he does it without the results is when you start to get to, all right, it gets tired, it gets whatever rote, it, you know, we're not listening to it, yada, yada, yada. But for now, if you're somebody who is of the self-help life coach vein, motivational grind culture vein, and that's no shade to you, that's how some people find the motivation in their life, you do have something with Deion Sanders, and it's something that I think Deion and Colorado know are very marketable, and they're marketing the hell out of it.
Hang on one second. This, like, don't cut this out. You're talking about books.
Oh boy, he's going to the shelf.
He's getting up.
Look, he's gotten up.
Have you ever read this thing?
What do we got?
Have you ever actually read this? How good do you want to be?
Saban, how
Nick
good
Saban's
do you
book
be? Is it?
No, I have.
Like Saban's famous book, which, by the way, this is, if in the video game culture we'd say reskinned, This is reskinned crimson. It used to be purple. This was written after his national title at LSU.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that.
Did you not know that?
No, I did not.
The whole thing, there's nothing about Alabama in here. This is all about his first championship team at LSU.
Oh, that's well done.
Here are the bullet points if you didn't want to read the book, which I advise that you don't. Organization, organization, organization. Motivate to dominate. No other way than right. Look in the mirror.
These are chapter titles, I'm assuming?
These are the bullet points that sell.
Oh, on the back jacket. Okay.
Yeah. And then, like, I did a secret-based video about Nick Saban once upon a time, so I read most of this. And it's like, there's not really anything here that another motivational speaker or coach or what. Like, it just, that market is just junk. And I'm not trying to say that college football coaches don't have good leadership advice. They have some great leadership advice. I've talked to coaches just in conversation, not on the record, about, you know, running a business or organization or motivation, that kind of stuff. But when it gets to that level, if that guy is selling basically pablum, you know, ipsum lorem from the motivational flavor, I'm not going to read Dion. And also, what about Dion's life is motivating me to listen to him about leadership? He's the head coach of a 4-8 team at the FBS level. He ran roughshod through the FCS for a hot minute because he successfully used the transfer portal. And then after that, he was a wildly, naturally talented professional athlete who was constantly inconsistent in locker rooms. So you hit the buzzer when I'm going in the wrong direction here, Richard, but his innate talent is to convince you that the publicity is part of the talent. Mm. It is very similar to sort of the reality star phenomenon. And in a lot of ways, he's sort of...
By the way,
he is a sort of original reality star of sports.
Right. Like, you don't say that as a pejorative. Like, he had a VH1, I believe, reality show that was like the entire family, and that was like 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, yeah, he did actually have a reality show. I was referring more to the idea Dion and what Dion said was sort of a separate and marketed brand back in a day in which that didn't happen. It was kind of loathed by, you know, the more conservative, more cloistered sports writer culture, if not that it's diverse and interesting now, but, you know, he did things specifically to advance sort of the Dion brand at a time in which that wasn't done. He's always been like that. The reason why, Richard, he could probably do this is if you're not making at-home visits in recruiting as a head coach,
you gotta do something.
Your schedule's free. And I don't know if this is going to fall in this category, but I see a lot of acclaim given to Dion that I don't see given to other coaches who just simply don't seek out the publicity for changing young men's lives. And I'm like, you have a reality. You have cameras on at the Colorado facility all the time that you're there. That's me telling you that as a reporter. I've talked to people like that have been around the program.
I mean, that's them. Anything telling you
when Dion's there, they turn on cameras. And so to go through any one of myriad hard emotional moments for a college athlete or college student, and then to have them filmed for the advancement of really just your head coach. It's just more, it's more of him advancing his brand. I don't see how that's necessarily like a him changing lives thing. I don't get it.
I find that the leader of men thing across college, let's talk about it just across college football for a second. I find that is something that a lot of people won't scratch the surface on, right? It's kind of like when anybody says, oh, I'm doing XYZ because of my faith. Like, you're like not allowed to like interrogate that, or you're not allowed to sort of like attempt to scratch under the surface because you've sort of said the blanket thing that justifies the action. And I think that leader of men in college football falls into that bucket, right? It's like, how much of a leader of men are you? And how much of a leader of men do you simply say that you are? And again, that is not Deion Sanders specific at all. That I apply that to every coach in college football who talks about themselves as a leader of men, as a second father figure, or as a, well, first father figure to some, any of that stuff.
That's like, real at lower levels. I think like Deion and Dabo and who else have we mentioned here? Richard Saban, all that kind of stuff. Like that definitely gets overplayed. That's not a Deion specific failure. But I know of stories of guys who, you know what the difference is, by the way, between the upper level and the lower level is time. So if you're a Division III head coach, or if you're just at a lower tier, or even in the FCS, like I know of stories of those coaches going out and like teaching a graduated player, like, here's how you apply for a home loan. Or, hey, let me call this person who's going to set you up on, like, you know, like walk you through a job interview. Or, hey, I want to be a head, you know, I want to be in the high school levels, like as a coach, you know, it's, I want to properly castigate these celebrity coaches for passing that shit off. But I also want to say that, like, we ask these people to be CEOs of billion-dollar companies where winning and losing is the only thing we measure them by. So, like, they don't really have time to be a father figure to 140-odd human beings.
Alex, do you think that portal culture actually detracts from your ability to be a father figure to XYZ player? Certainly you are going to have some players that stay in your program 3 or 4 years and go to the NFL, but you're also going to have a lot more players that come in for a year, maybe two, that had a, in scare quotes, father figure at school one or school two, and are now coming to you as school two or school three for not that long. And as more of a fully formed man than coming to you June at age 17 or when they just turned 18, maybe they're 21 or 22, more of a fully formed man, so to speak. And so you don't get that. Can you still do that, or does it detract from it?
Yeah, I think that Deion's manner of managing the program completely undermines, or should, the idea that he pitches that he was called to do this and that he has really hammed up more than some about being a leader of men. It's not just that you're cycling players in and out of your roster rapidly and changing your tune about them rapidly. A year ago, you're Louis Vuitton. Now, what are we losing? That's a lot of the same players, because almost everyone on the roster transferred in last year or came in last year. But it's also like, it's a matter of effort too, isn't it? Like, recruiting high school players is harder than recruiting transfers. I think that the vast majority of people who work in personnel in college football would tell you that. It's harder for two reasons. It's harder because, one, you don't know how their game is going to translate to college football. So it's a bigger scouting effort. It's more based upon projection, and there's more growth ahead of these players because you're looking at them when they're 16, 17, 18 instead of 18, 19, 20, 21. So it's harder there. And it's also harder because, frankly, there's a bigger gap between you and them. They're even younger. They have even less life experience. They have even less of an understanding of the way that college football works and the way that they might fit into what you're doing culturally or off the field. There's no transfer portal for high school players, right? You still have to, I mean, there's a 24/7 page, but you still have to make the effort, get in touch with probably someone at the high school to set up a visit and go and do a whole dog and pony show.
It's functionally harder to recruit a high school kid. Like,
yeah, most
of
get on the plane.
Most of these transfers and grad transfers are, some of them are doing it without making a visit, Alex. Like, some of them are just doing it.
So exactly. And I want to close this point. It is harder. It is a higher effort enterprise to go and be good at high school recruiting, but it is what the greats do. And he wants to be one of them. Like, it is what they do. And the portal is a crucial way to supplement your roster if you want to be great. But the greats still recruit high school players, and they do it really well. And that's how they build the foundation of their program. And he's just not doing it. And Shadur, presumably with his dad's blessing, is posting Instagram stories like, transfers, if you want to play here, get in touch. The idea that you can be like this kind of sublime leader of young men, but then not really try to do like the main thing that becomes the lifeblood of any good organization in this arena, which is prep recruiting, it just seems odd to me. Like not being willing to pound the pavement and wanting to do the work from home version of recruiting, which is what the portal is. I'm working from home right now, but I don't, but our podcast doesn't depend. Fortunately, this would be a little weird on me going into high schools and trying to get kids to come and okay, work for us.
But who cares if he doesn't want to do this?
Well, why, I mean, like, why we're are assessing, we... we're assessing him, aren't we?
Right. But I mean,
I think from a perspective of what he's trying to build at Colorado, and this kind of sits on the fence between the whole like leader of men chat, like what does Deion represent and how good can Colorado actually be at football? So Richard, sorry if I'm breaking your rule.
Well, I don't know if Deion's going to be the accurate way we can measure how good Colorado football can be.
Well, then that's a change because last year there were people with takes, people that we respect. You've had Dan Wetzel on the program before.
There's a lot of dumb takes
talking
last
about
year.
Dan was talking about how Deion could win a national championship in Colorado.
No one did a worse job with Deion last year than the college football media. Absolutely. He was SI Sportsman of the Year. He went 4-8.
Richard didn't pick him.
I know Richard didn't pick him, but like, if you read that profile, it's something between AI and The Onion.
I would. I'll tell you this about how that went.
Because of like, why was he Sportsman of the Year? Because of television ratings?
I'll tell you some of how that broke down. Some of that has to do with who wasn't able to be picked as Sportsman of the Year. Some of that has to, which is an access thing, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing was also when that decision was made. That decision got made before the downswell. When you saw the magazine come out and the announcement come out, it was significantly after they had begun the 8-loss winning streak, as someone who was sort of in on such conversations.
But Richard, I don't know if there was a good time of year to pick him as Sportsman of the Year.
September was cool. I can put myself back where I was in September. Remember, Steven, no, I want to be clear about this. We, all three of us, and you go back and find the receipts, turned out to be very right about what Colorado was going to be last year. We asked before the year on the preview, is this going to happen? We were all like, no. They went 4-8. But I bailed. In September, I thought they were going to make a bowl game. I didn't think they were going to win the Pac-12, but I thought they were going to make a bowl game. Alex, and that was cool. They were 1-11.
I've said to you multiple times, on the show, off the show, whatever, it was not unreasonable to think a 3-0 team, even a 3-1 team that had just got their asses crunched by Oregon, was going to end up in the postseason. That's not at all unreasonable. Was not at all unreasonable.
Anyway, a lot's changed. Like, I feel less bullish.
Doctor's shaking his head, but you cannot sit here and tell me as a straight face on October 1st, even after they had lost to Oregon the way they lost to Oregon and I was there in person, that team wasn't going to end up getting 6 or 7. I don't think that's unreasonable at all.
You're begging for me to play the schedule game.
Stop it. Don't do it. October 1st.
Alex hates it, so of course I gotta do it now. Please. You said October 1st?
After the Oregon game was. Sorry.
Okay. Right. So let's take people back. They're 3-0 on beating a bad TCU, a 5-7 TCU team by 3.
That you didn't know was gonna go 5-7 on October 1st or what have you.
Right. But yeah, you're cheating, like Steven.
Yeah,
you're cheating. No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Gather context as you go.
Godfrey.
Holy fuck. You shit, we're doing it again.
No, that's crap.
All right, 36-14 over a stellar Nebraska team who I believe was bound for the Orange Bowl. A double overtime 3-point win over a Colorado State team, sub .500.
You are still sitting here doing it with what you know about those teams on January 1st.
This entire fucking industry built it in the last 5-6 years. They look at SP Plus, they look at advanced analytics. I saw the dumbest shit from the smartest people last year because it was something new and interesting in September. I've never ever seen the college football rank and file media respond to television ratings and use that as a justification for just dumb content, conjecture, and just like bad ways of thinking about like how to construct, like what's interesting, what's newsworthy. This this television ratings thing poisoned the well on media, because I think there's a greater anxiety about college football and a greater anxiety about media. And I think when Deion started, when the idea of like the results of the Colorado State game showing up on First Take, I think a lot of media people, their brains are so fried and broken from living in this generation, which is basically a never ending depression, but like in terms of employment and finances, that they were like, oh, we need to talk about this more. We need to make this a bigger thing. And when in actuality, this was never a great team. They got fucking annihilated by Oregon. Okay. Which, to Richard's point, I would still say, could you have found three more wins? Yes, I guess. I was actually more encouraged by the idea of them bowling was the following week, because they were able to score points on USC, which again, we didn't know. Oh, but we kind of did, that Alex Grinch sucked, right? Like, we kind of knew. This idea that we were supposed to treat them in a vacuum when we don't treat anything in a vacuum, I don't understand where that came from. They weren't that good. Why is it controversial to say this?
Nope. Wait,
why can't people just come out and say, hey, the 3-0 thing was a lot of hysteria and hype?
It was, but nobody was we on the show were not conflating 3-0 with 12-0. We were conflating most it with 7-5.
Most of the national media most of the national media had them at like a they're like, well, I mean, this could be a 9-10 win team at the 3-0 mark.
Not us. And the conversation.
Yeah, don't you think it's kind of fucking weird when people you otherwise respect are falling in such a dumb manner? Don't you want to ask why?
That's not what I'm interested in the current spot. We were talking about us. We were talking about...
But we talked about...
Steven, I don't know.
Here's
I don't
the know, deal. Steven. I guess down the stretch. I guess. Now, remember, we're not supposed to know what we're not supposed to know. So at that 3-0 mark, and then maybe you even give them USC, like I said.
Sure.
They had Arizona State, Stanford, UCLA, Oregon State, Arizona, Wazoo, and Utah. Those are the games down the stretch. Now, they lost every game after they beat Arizona by 3.
I will give them
some credit in the fact that, like, you know, it's weird, just as an aside, because it's come up twice now, because they're on the schedule this year and next. Like, this is why I start to like get old PAPN pissed off about Colorado. Why aren't we talking about like Arizona? Like, Arizona had a phenomenal fucking year last year and like weirdly won't die. They still have like a really good like core in place even after they lose their coach and they're financially broke and they're going to a new conference. And it's like, we're talking about this guy because he was on TV for 20 fucking years and playing all these hypothetical games. I get frustrated when we get into this because you guys are asking me to separate how dumb everyone else acted about this, but that's kind of that might be the most interesting part of this whole equation.
Well, Steven, from my perspective, one, we have talked, I'm sure we will talk about Arizona. It is cool that Noah Fifita and Tedaro McMillan didn't leave and that they were able to, you know, keep those guys. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
People always yell at me and they're like, why aren't you being positive about something? Like, that's a cool thing.
But to be clear, like, I think the reason that we are doing a Colorado episode right now is that we did one in September. We'll do one now. And that might get, I mean, we'll probably talk about them in bits, but like, my thought is that as long as this is the thing that is like a top five headline around the sport eternally, you might as well try to find an interesting way into it.
Why is it honestly the headline right now? Is it anything positive at all?
Well, I think to Richard's point, it's the headline right now because when you talk about Colorado, you're talking about at least four different things at any given time.
This week they're talking about the fact that the roster got rocked again.
We're talking about Colorado and we're interested in Colorado, I think, because it's complex, and which is what I said at the top of the show.
And that I agree with.
You, Stephen Godfrey, and we, Split Zone Duo, and me, Richard Johnson, are interested in talking about and interrogating complex stories in this sport. Colorado is complex, and Colorado is one of the teams that I think is uniquely complex because of where it is in the country, or in the rankings, I should say. You just sat here and talked about, why do you talk this much about a 4-8 team? Because they're this complex, and they're this complex, whether you like it or not, because that guy is the head coach first and foremost.
Yeah, it's a celebrity culture. And it makes, I mean, cult of personality usually makes the cult dumber. And that's what's happening here. And I think that's why I'm having a tough time digesting it, is because it does get oversimplified. It does get reductive.
And
I mean, it's
to one of the things that we talk about, because about that bowl game conversation, I actually pulled up SP Plus from week 5 when Colorado was mid 70s and they were with a 48th ranked offense at the time in SP Plus. They had Arizona State on their schedule left. Arizona State was about 10 places worse than them. They had Stanford, which was about team 100 at that time. In SP Plus, Washington State is on here as well. And Washington State was like, what was Wazoo? Scroll to Wazoo. I can't find it in here. But Wazoo was not like ahead of them in the rankings. That's when I talk about, and that's what I get into, what you knew.
That's 6
in early,
or 7.
Right. When you get into early October, what you knew about them in early October versus what you knew about the rest of their schedule and the sanity of thinking that they would end up making a bowl. Okay.
But I guess the other thing too is that we do know what happens next. What happens next is they start losing games, and then also you have the offensive shuffle, the coaching problem, everything else that happens. There was no revisiting and readjusting. And then he's Sportsman of the Year at SI, and then all this kind of stuff just marches on, and we go into the offseason with the same stupid stuff. I am probably expecting a level of intelligence from a large group, like a larger audience, that I'm not going to get. Deion plays to the rafters. Deion plays to a cross-section of people who don't care about college football, which we can get into in a second, because I think it's probably the most interesting thing here. Inside of football, it's going to ring as weird or dumb to people like me, and I've learned to accept that. I still can't get over how dumb people I think are smart reacted inside of our space. I don't watch First Take. I don't watch any of those holler box TV shows on the cable nets. That doesn't really concern or interest me. But we got swept up. And the reasons we got swept up really like chap my ass, because it's a great symptom of what's wrong in college football. As if anybody who's a journalist should give a fuck about television ratings. Following television is how we ended up in this fucking vortex we're in now.
Steven, I don't think that...
Enjoy Oregon at Purdue, though.
No, look... Television ratings and allegiance to them has obviously been a bad thing for, like, the enterprise, the collective enterprise.
Everyone.
College football.
Except television network.
But I think that you can't entirely be a snob about, oh, like, all these people are watching Colorado football. Like, that's kind of interesting. What's that all about?
I never said being a snob. I said, definitely write the story. Hey, go on the ground. Send David Ubbin out there for a year. Do we need to light a candle, by the way? Has he been freed from Boulder?
David is doing very well.
Look, Boulder itself is quite nice from what I hear.
Boulder's lovely, but...
Never been.
We'll get into the racial dynamic of Great College Town in a second. It's the Fort Collins fallacy, I believe, that we invented on this show. Everyone wants to go to college at Colorado State if their name's McKenzie and they're from Gwinnett County. Write the story. Write the profile. It'll be a write around because he's controlling his own media. You know, it'll be Sinatra has a cold. But don't be dumb. Everyone got dumb. That's all I'm asking, is that hysteria washed over everybody. And, you know, the other thing that, like, to go back to that month, you know what I remember now is, like, do you remember the rappers on the sidelines and the stuff that, like, we've seen a million other coaches do? It was suddenly embraced as like, this guy's changing college football. I'm like, motherfucker, Mark D'Antonio had Rich Homie Quan on the sidelines of Michigan State. I can't think of a more boring sideline than a Mark D'Antonio Michigan State sideline. And Rich Homie Quan was there when they won the Big Ten championship. We suddenly got into the deification of Deion. And that's where, as a coach and as like a, he's changing the game. And I'm like, the other thing, and let's just go ahead and get into it, Richard, is that I keep seeing all this stuff like he's making it blacker. Have you asked a black head coach or assistant coach in college football about Deion off the record?
You don't have to do it off the record. Remember Eddie Robinson at Alabama State? No relation, by the way, as we've been over. Incredible. To Eddie Robinson from Grambling. Said he ain't swack, I'm swack. There was a desire among the HBCU coaches to beat Deion. They saw Deion as a stopover.
I'll take it a step further. But like, yes, it was. I'll take it a step further. because there's a weird thing about the SWAC and the MEAC and HBCU, which is there's a division, and this is one of those conversations they don't have in front of the whites, but sometimes I sneak into the picnic. I am white, so I do be careful how I say this. In the HBCUs, there's an expectation that you should play within that culture and that you should isolate yourself in that culture and you should sacrifice your career for that culture a lot of times, especially in coaching. And players too, and in recruiting, like, oh, you're black. Imagine what you could do for the HBCUs if you did that.
Imagine
what are the HBCUs equipped to offer you?
Yeah, imagine if the five stars all went to whatever HBCU.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of happened.
Yes. There's a Jemele Hill Bomani argument from a couple years ago that probably best defines that conflict within the black community. To which I say, y'all have at it. I don't need to be in that argument.
This is what Godfrey's talking about is this conversation succinctly. And it is, are you in the HBCU culture or are you of the HBCU culture? There are doing what Deion did, which is pretty well figuring it out in white America and then coming into the HBCU culture and part and parcel telling HBCUs what is wrong, what is deficient. Ed Reed did a similar thing at Bethune-Cookman. What you can and can't do, what you should and shouldn't be doing. I know the answers, yada, yada, yada. That is typically not very well received from people within HBCUs. And that goes beyond athletics. I want to be very clear about this. This goes beyond
athletics. No. Yeah. Oh, it's huge in politics in the South.
And academia.
Black political.
Coming into these,
and again, it's not something that's represented, and so I don't feel like we might be educating some folks on this, Richard. But like, I know all this mainly from being from the Deep South and working as a journalist in places like Mississippi.
So as you all know,
there's a big division there. And how about this, Richard? Just real fast, what if he had just gone to like instead of Jackson State? What if it had been like Sela or like Nichols, or like I'm pulling all these Louisianas, like if he had done what he did at McNeese,
right?
The HBCU part of it, to Alex's original point, which is not what I was he ruffled a particular community,
because remember,
a kind of gilded community in the inside the black space, and that is like its own fuck up.
Remember, like the game one, like they had like the stuff that was stolen out of the lockers and like all that stuff. It's the example is this. If I would have, if I went to the University of Florida, everybody knows it. It's a very white school. Look it up. If I would have gone to FAMU, if I would have taken a job at FAMU and said, this is how we did XYZ at Florida, and we should do it this way at FAMU. Like, it just doesn't work that way. Yeah. It doesn't, and it's certainly not going to be well received. And so there is a, Godfrey, your point about outsiders glomming on to the Deion phenomenon because of Deion. It's an interesting celebrity stand culture argument here when we bring it into the bounds of the race conversation that I wanted to have with Deion Sanders, because when you have outsiders of the sport writ large find Deion Sanders because they love Deion Sanders and follow him to an HBCU, that has its own issues. That has its own sort of wake to it, right?
Yeah.
And then when you have them follow him to Colorado of all places, that has its own wake of issues. And so you have all of these things that get wrapped up in Deion Sanders, black man, black coach in a very, very white job, FBS head coach at a very, very white place, University of Colorado, Boulder, doing these very, very black things. Bringing rappers to the sideline, having the rock in the locker room, you know, whatever, on and on and on. You know what I'm talking about. And so the race conversation with Deion is so interesting and so multifaceted and so complex because, yes, it is a conversation about race in America, so it is a complex thing. Doesn't mean we shouldn't have the conversation, but it is to talk about what the conversation is about. There are plenty of things that I cheerlead about Deion and think are great about Dion as a black celebrity having success in this very white place. But then there are some other things that I don't think are so great. And you, as a black man, that's on me personally to sort of shoulder both things as a critic of culture in this respect, and as an onlooker of college football, and as a critic of college football, and as someone who tries to parse all these different things. So yeah, great that he is doing things that are just, to borrow the phrase, unapologetically black at Colorado. Yeah. Not awesome that he did these things at Jackson, or left Jackson in the way that he did, and that sort of stuff.
Here's the this is the stat that I came across from ESPN. It arrived on my doorstep. This is from an ESPN document. Colorado accounts for 5 of the 15 most viewed 2023-2024 regular season college football games and 7 of the top 15 game casts this season at ESPN.com. So that's a lot. Disproportionate 4-8 team doesn't make sense. Where did that audience come from? We asked our, I mean, we kind of pondered openly, where is this flood coming from? Because I don't think I can claim this, but I remember thinking at the time, I don't know if I said it on any of the shows, I don't think people are pulling away from the Ohio State game or the, you know, the big SEC CBS game at the time to do this. I think it was newcomers coming in, and it looks like I was right. So the stat is that this is a bullet point from presentation. Multicultural viewership swelled, accounting for 40% of the overall audience. Now, you're going to ask, what is the normal multicultural audience for a college football game at ESPN? 26% for a non-Colorado game. Just to give you an idea, at least in ESPN's own internal metrics, they're assuming, or that they're going to tell you that 26% of viewers are non-white. 40% are non-white watching Colorado. So what that means is Colorado games look something like this. 2.4 million on average multicultural viewers. And that's just non-white. You can take that for whatever you want to. 3.6 million white viewership. Now, they've got another stat that I don't know if it necessarily applies, because I don't know if they're talking about in time slots. And if you remember, the other weird phenomenon about all this was that it was a Colorado season. So it wasn't like they were slotted for a lot of like,
no, the Colorado,
you know, great
thinking,
spots.
Colorado's thinking it was like 10:30.
Yeah. Yeah. So we know
late.
That
was a fun night.
We know actually. That a large audience came in. We know that they were less white than the traditional college football audience. And we know what college football audiences look like. We run a college football company. All right. This is where we get into a really interesting shift. And this is where things, and Richard's entire effort on this episode is to try and pull these things out and speak factually and then inform them with context where we normally would. But you inevitably arrive at a conversation in Colorado that's either too layered or too uncomfortable for people to have, honestly. And that's, I think, ultimately our responsibility is to still talk about it in an educated way. There are facets of Deion Sanders that mirror Nick Saban or Kirby Smart or Dabo Swinney or any of the sort of white authority icons that college football fans from a predominantly white culture have built up. The same thing has happened with Deion in aspects of the black community and this large increase in black viewership. You don't need to really figure out why. Okay. It is fundamentally identity politics, and it's about representation. It's about seeing yourself. And it does speak right to that uncomfortable dynamic of white authority figure, black labor figure in most of the modern history of college football. But what has also happened is this. We are not yet at a point as a society where we are tolerating minority audiences holding conflicting ideas in public amongst themselves. We still don't do it. We're still a predominantly white culture. They're still very traditional and conservative in a lot of ways. So what Richard said earlier was, as a black man, I have thoughts about Deion that conflict. That's basically the summary of what you said, right?
Yes, that's fair.
I think I can have two competing thoughts about something that involves the idea of blackness or the impact on a black community. And some can be positive and some can be negative. We are too reductive online. We are too sort of self-segregated in how we build up our political identities. And by the way, this is a symptom of both all sides of all functions of the political spectrum. This doesn't really have a lot to do with conservatism. This is actually, so it's funny you were talking about Colorado being a white place. It's such a performatively white place too. It's like such a, I've got to show you how liberal I am kind of culture, which I think is extra hilarious to when you do have an unapologetically black experience and you have these people who are so uncomfortable with their whiteness, which is like this sect of like upper class white people that always want to move conversations away from economics and towards politics. And Colorado is a great experiment for that. It's fascinating.
Hey, so you're going to see a lot of work there a little bit.
No,
Colorado is a rapidly changing state.
Go to Colorado, I think, would be showing my work.
Times. No, Alex, no, don't go to Colorado. Christ. No, don't go to Colorado. Go to Boulder.
Right. Go to Boulder. Go to CU.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of Patagonia. I understand that. Like, but,
Alex. It's all right, Steven. Hey, go to Boston. Right. Go to Boston.
Careful, I will.
Go to any Ivy. Go anywhere in New England. I mean, do you really want me to do this? Go to any coastal elite school. Like, hey, dude, if you're uncomfortable with the idea of like self-loathing progressive white Democrats, like,
I'm not uncomfortable with it.
It's a thing.
I'm not uncomfortable with it. I come from it, arguably. I'm just telling you, like,
yeah, arguably. You know, yeah. But what I'm telling you is that Colorado's a great experiment.
East Coast, I don't know. But all I'm saying is showing your work would be fine. Like, I do think that it's an interesting experiment.
My work
though.
Is Boulder, Colorado. Right. It's literally any lifestyle piece or portrayal or anything. Like,
here's
if you've been awake for 20 years, I don't need to show my work. And if you're being honest about white people.
Let me expand on this, though. This is not, I mean, we've talked about this in Colorado Dead Letters, which our paying subscribers can go back and listen to. Going back to Bill McCartney, it has not been that hard for someone to go to Boulder, Colorado, coach the football team, and do just fine politically with a vastly different worldview, message, type of whole thing than the Patagonia person thing that you're describing.
Is not the conversation we're having here. That is not the conversation we're having.
These are liberal white institutions, usually in academia, that are doing everything they can. They're falling over themselves to basically do a sort of display type of multiculturalism.
Bingo.
When in actuality, all they're doing is getting a check mark so they can continue on with the same privileged economically, you know, 1-10% lifestyle. They're doing it's performative liberalism. The entire year, the calendar year of 2020, if you pulled up Instagram, like, you know, That's what I'm talking about. This is the kind of like non-active performative bullshit that like Boulder's a great case study for. So when Dion comes in, I think it's funny to watch the sort of like prescribed uncomfortable embrace.
The example
and that like that's what makes me laugh. The example as like a redneck.
The example is this right here. To whatever degree Boulder is black, it ain't that much. I think it's less than 10. I looked it up one time. The example is this. I think people in Boulder, Colorado, because they're white people, so I can sort of speak pretty authoritatively about this phenomenon. I think they're fine with 40% of the television audience being black. Let 40% of the population in Boulder, Colorado magically become black overnight and see what happens.
Oh, yeah. There's one thing, being considered cool amongst black culture and then actually living with black culture is the definition of like north and south of the, like, at least the east side of the United States.
Yes.
Like, it's like you like, oh God, it's great that you love hip hop and stuff and you grew up in Westchester County, but like the phrase NIMBY exists for a reason. It's different when you're like in a state that's majority black. That's what I think Richard is getting at. Sorry, I'm trying not to laugh, this is why Jordan Peele made a fucking movie about this. Like, this is that kind of like, oh, can I touch your hair? Liberalism kind of shit.
And this is Godfrey, like,
this has we're getting to a point. I swear to God, but I'm also enjoying it.
A point out of this is this: you talked about as somebody being black, holding conflicting views about, you know, a black man in a whatever position.
Yeah.
Part of it is because there's not that many of them. Like, if there
were... Which is why you don't want to have that conversation in public.
Like, if there were more than 13 of 130 blackhead... If there were 50, if we had some semblance of parity, again, remember, the playing force, labor force, 50% black, coaches, 13 or 14 out of 130. If you had 70 blackhead coaches, can have plenty of nuance. Some of them can fall by the wayside and we don't care, what have you. It's like, and Dominic Foxworth, I think, has made this point. He used to play for the Broncos, and the Ravens has made this point. We're at a point, or we're right about at a point with black quarterbacks where we're all black NFL quarterbacks, where we're comfortable telling you which ones are good and which ones aren't.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
I make yes, this, yes. like, I think yes. I can't remember who I was making this point about, but it's like, I will lie like shit about who, like, whatever, black quarterback, like Josh Freeman, whatever, pick one out of thin air, because there's like four black starting quarterbacks in 2009 versus now, where you're getting to a level of parity where there are plenty of them,
right.
where I can say that the platonic ideal of the black quarterback is actually Jacoby Brissett. It's not Patrick Mahomes. It's that Jacoby Brissett can be on five different teams and it actually be fine. And he's a career backup, and that's good.
I wish I could cite my work here or like where I've read this, but let's think of football and sports as entertainment for a second, and let's think about the multicultural. There's just, God, I hate that word. Let's think about white and black representation across major forms of entertainment. Okay, in the music industry now, it is more non-white than it ever has been in terms of what's popular, what sells, who has power, who has equity, and who has ownership. Okay. Conversely, what you see are these conversations that are allowed to exist, such as popular and public criticism of hip hop or R&B or different types of genres of music and individuals therein, right? You have a diversification of opinion, but it's not just a celebration. It's not just, let's raise minorities up. We're never going to say anything dissenting. It's because they actually got enough of a foothold to start having the more interesting conversations in the accepted space.
And critique.
And black coaching. Critique. Yes, and black coaching is not there yet. And so going back to move all the way around to that original point of ask a black assistant in college football about Deion, Deion's not here to raise up black college football coaches. Deion's here to raise up Deion. The double-edged sword of Deion is that exactly what Richard just said. It's going to be really hard to be as precise and exact with criticism without running up against the fact that there are a disproportionate amount of white head coaches. All right? So you can have a lot of qualms with Deion, but the bottom line is this is still a scant representation of the actual picture of what college football looks like in terms of skin tone.
And Godfrey,
that's frustrating for people.
And Godfrey, you end up in, so this is, I think me and you have joked about this. With some of these critiques, and this is why I think part of the reason why having the conflating ideas is a little bit difficult, because when you start down the critique cycle, you end up in circles where you're sort of sharing the room with, you look around and you're sharing the room with some of the people critiquing. You're like, I don't know if this is.
I don't know how I feel about it. Yes. But that's the whole, we don't have this conversation around white people axiom. That's the whole, that's how the Chris Rock ended his special about the whole Will Smith thing. And there's, white people get so fucked off about that, but it's just closing ranks for a reason. It's a survival instinct. And so, you know, what's really funny that I came across the other day was, of all people, Jay Norvell has paid out of pocket to create a minority like in coaching endowment at CSU. Of all, and I say of all places because that's like become Deion's like coterie of supervillains. That's like one of his, like, that's his, you know, if not his Joker, then at least his fucking Riddler. That's someone that if the Post said, hey, can you do a sit rep on the state of minority coaching? I'm not going to call Deion. I'm going to call Jay Norvell, who's been in the industry much, much longer and dealt with the actual reality of the situation, good and mainly bad, at major institutions like Texas and Oklahoma, right? That's the problem with race. Now, the bridge, and this is what I was trying to get at, and we're in this weird moment where, like, I posted a tweet from Tyreek Hill, and it's dated, what, about a week ago, a week and change ago, yeah. Where Jeff Schwartz, at least, I don't know if he's a friend of the program. I worked with him at SB Nation. I don't know if you guys have overlapped.
Yeah, I've met Jeff before. I actually met Jeff.
Jeff, the Piesman, yeah. Right,
Jeff, yes, Jeff that's once right. body
Jeff,
slammed
Jeff was involved
me
with the Piesman. Yeah.
While I was dressed in a plastic orb for a
nice
content stunt.
That's right. Sponsor. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Wow.
Nice guy.
Yeah. Not an episode goes by where Jewish we don't NFL do something player. Like.
Yeah, we got along.
That's
yeah.
right. He is. Yeah. He's, yeah. Him, yeah, him yeah. Bill Goldberg, and
Mitch Berger. Not many yeah, of us.
He saved you on that one, didn't he? He pulled
mostly
out fire.
Who else we got? Jeff's brother,
Josh,
Mitchell
Josh
Schwartz.
Miller. It's another punter. Yeah. No. Anyway, as Is you he? Were, as you were, Stephen.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, could we Tyreek get to 10? Could we get to 10?
This
not
is
Tyreek Hill. I don't. I mean, you could have him over for Passover, but I don't think he's. You know, I don't think he knows any Hebrew.
This is where Godfrey borders into the culture conversation exercise. Not, which is not to say I'm bugging you. This is where to say take it.
Oh, but the problem is this is where you have to fucking start with Colorado, which is why Richard set it up and we got here backwards, is because you have to acknowledge the real and sober football things to then acknowledge the fucking layers of circus on top. So Jeff Schwartz retweeted some guy named Bud Elliott, who was, and look, man, shout out, because we'll all get a text message on the group thread in a second once he hears this. Bud's been getting him off. Bud's a volume shooter. Bud's been getting him off on the there was an Instagram story, I believe, from Shiloh about like, hey, transfers, holler at me, you know, whatever it was. And so Bud tweeted, interesting strategy following today's liquidation of last year's Louis. Jeff retweeted it and just said, and Jeff's an Oregon alumnus, so maybe there's some Pac-12 bravado. I don't know.
But he said, it can't be that Jeff's alma mater beat them by 50 points in one of the most uncompetitive football games.
I mean, like they fucking stole something. Unserious program is what Jeff said. And then Tyreek Hill comes in and says, how is it unserious? They just don't follow rules like these other boring programs. And this is where we arrive at the moment where to Richard's point about you look around the room, and this doesn't apply to Bud, but this does apply to a lot of people. You want to talk about conversations that are behind closed doors about what white people are saying about Colorado. This is where it gets weird, because there is an automatic move into a space of this is what's your motivation here? You don't want to see a black man succeed, right? So they're jumping 2 and 3 squares ahead because, hey, we've had that experience before. But the reality is it a serious program by standards? Does it have to be a serious program by standards? And this is where we go all the way back around, Alex, to the original conversation, which is like, hey, maybe you can't fucking portal an offensive line. Maybe you have to develop these guys. Maybe you have to get a good O-line coach in there. Maybe, like, the problem is when you ask football questions or even make football comments about Colorado, and you do it from any perch in the media now, you get thrown up into the stratosphere as like, well, you hate Dion or you're racist. And it's like, no, I just think this shit might be real fucked up.
I think Colorado football taps into the same thing that cryptocurrency taps into, and that a certain type of Silicon Valley brain taps into. I'm serious. I think that we are in
American
age where disruption, doing something differently, is cross-racially something that has an audience. And this idea is pretty easy to sell, that if you're not seeing that we're doing things differently, then you're missing out on the future. And maybe we are.
Or you maybe hate the future.
Like maybe we're going to miss the wave and Colorado's going to go to the moon. It probably sounds condescending. And like, if you read my Slate writing about a lot of bankrupt and corrupt crypto concerns, you might think that I have and you might be right, that I have a generally negative view of this ecosystem. But I'm serious that I think right now, in the last like 10, 15 years in America and probably the world, it's just been really cool to be edgy and different to a certain type of crowd. And I think Dion appeals to that type of crowd. And I think it also interacts with the dynamic of him being a strong, powerful black man that you're just talking about. And
I also think this is the age, Alex, and I don't know how much this factors into your theory, but this is the era of athlete media where it's like, oh, I live my truth. And it's like, I have my own podcast. I have my own YouTube channel. Don't listen to what the NBA media said about me. This is, you know, that kind of thing. He really he's celebrated by those who are like, no, I'm going to control my own message. Don't believe the media.
Tyreek Hill, who streams a lot, for instance. There is a Gen Z nature to everything about the culture around the program, which is a little bit of what Alex is honestly getting at. By the way, I do think for programs who are outside of the top 20,
you might want to borrow some of their media tactics.
Of their media tactics. Guess what? If you went 5-7 last year, maybe you should vlog all your practices. Why not? What do you have to lose?
As we record this, Richard, I'm interrupting. Dylan Edwards is entering the portal.
You're kidding. That is not a plant. That is, I literally did not know that.
I just had Twitter. I had Twitter in a back window and then switched over as we were recording. So I only have two things left to say. One, Alex, did you know that you can still buy NF Tuck, which is the NFTs for Mel Tucker at Michigan State?
How's that doing?
Still active.
How's that doing?
I don't know. You can still buy them because one of our listeners, yeah. And I'm sorry I didn't remember your name, on one of the social platforms that we're on said, hey, guys, you should buy some NF Tuck. Which, by the way, a guy who got fired for beating it at work and it's called NF Tuck, I just feel like that's too close. And then the last thing I'm going to say is it's going to be really funny when on the white hot, pardon the pun, culture war, race war, fringe media bullshit, that we're spending all this time on Deion as the black man and Deion as the black coach. And like, what if it's Fran Brown in 2 or 3 years that's actually like the revolutionary young black head coach who changes the paradigm in college football? I think like you may be getting okey-doked right now if you're not paying attention to someone like him
or Deshaun Foster
versus
at UCLA.
Yeah. There's no reason I wouldn't say him.
I know. It's just what came to mind.
Yeah. I've heard some early returns in the Northeast about Fran, and also like it's also a little bit like, wait, why is that black coach leaving? Why is that black assistant leaving Georgia to go to fucking where? Like, but apparently it's working early. So we'll
see. It's definitely working early. Definitely working early. We will talk more about Syracuse.
And that's the nature of sort of the Gen Z culture around this program. I think is curious because you've got somebody who is more than an athlete in Deion's case, more than a coach, right? He's selling sunglasses. He's selling shoes. He's selling Boost mobile phones. He's selling shirts. Like I had a friend of mine's kid I saw was wearing a Colorado Believe shirt in decidedly not Colorado, and they are not Colorado grads, right? You have all of these people who are rooting for Deion Sanders wherever Deion Sanders is. You have all of these people rooting for LeBron wherever LeBron is, right? That is a modern nature of fandom that Deion is bringing to college football, where college football, and I think college football even more than the NFL, is about an institutional fandom, right? With a capital I, because it's more.
Oh yeah, it's
than
like
just
a religion the, that you're raised in. Right? Yeah,
and it's more than just a football team, right? You're when the school that you love or or is your alma mater says they're building a new engineering building, it's something that you have a source of pride in because it's an institution that you are rooting for more than just a team. But that notion of like Shador or Shiloh, one of the Sanders sons, going on Instagram and saying, you know, if you can play, hit us up. Like,
yeah, Shador. Yeah.
It's new, right? It's, you know, you have the detractors who say they're playing for clicks. Dan Lanning, Cormani McClain, who just transferred, is a 5-star cornerback who transferred and said, you know, I didn't want to play for clicks. Like, you have people that are going to buy into it and people that aren't. And I think that what you have in the Gen Z cryptocurrency 2024 nature of the discourse is also polarization. You have and what I hope that we've done, or I hope that I've gotten across, is that I am much more in the middle on a lot of this stuff than I find a lot of people. And that is a place where I don't want to say I feel alone, because I don't think that's fair to people, but it's where it's certainly the minority opinion of Colorado football and the Colorado football experience. It is certainly easier to be on one side of either it's going to work or it's not. But when it just goes back to the Conceitus episode, when I ask somebody what's working about it, I have to have a conversation about what they define as working. Define work. Because
what if,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I had this posed to me by a coach when I was doing just research on something else. And I would probably characterize this coach as a Deion hater, but I don't meet a lot of Deion likers. He said, something that I was like, all right, I'll bring that to the show. What if all of this was to simply build and extend the Deion brand into something else 4 or 5 years from now? Meaning like he's not going to be at Colorado, but he's also not going to be at like Florida State or the Dallas Cowboys, right? And what if this was all just a sort of like, to Alex's point, Silicon Valley entertainment executive brained scheme to get his kid, a quarterback, into the best situation possible that he could control from a media and branding and ownership standpoint to then head to the NFL? Meaning, what if this was all just focused around Shador on an arc? Because a lot of coaches right now, the number one criticism I'm getting now is Deion's going to run into something at the end of 2025, which is that coaches are going to start saying, okay, you can go there and you can get on NIL and this attention, but who has he developed other than his son and the players that he treats like his son, meaning like Travis, right? Who else has he really actually developed? That's going to be the number one knock against him. And then it's going to be the sort of second question or comment that I get from coaches is he going to be doing all this when Shador is playing in the NFL 2-3 years out of college? Like, is he still going to be doing all this? It just doesn't seem likely.
It's a lot of work.
He doesn't want to keep the pace now. Why would he do it in 5 years?
Yeah.
Over under. I mean, the guy's not there in 2026. He's just not.
The extension of the Deion brand is interesting because I think I made this point on one of our earlier shows that we talked about Colorado, is like nothing about the Deion brand has not included success, right? If I'm Godfrey, please correct me if I'm wrong, but he was on the Braves World Series teams, right?
He didn't win in 95, but he was on the 91 and 92 season teams. Yeah. So okay. The whole playing in two games in one day thing, that involves a postseason game and then playing against the Niners, I believe.
In
the
92, same day. Right. No, so, okay. So he wasn't 92, on the
West. Yeah. That's the Tim McCarver. The greatest thing Deion Sanders ever did was cover this dipshit named Tim McCarver in like beer or champagne. Yes. After McCarver, of all things, criticized a human being for attempting to play in an NFL game and a postseason baseball game in the same day. It's hard if you're listening to this and you're like 19. You're like, who in the world wouldn't celebrate that? Like, wouldn't that be the greatest sports story of the year? And this baseball purist fuckhead named Tim McCarver, who was also a St. Louis Cardinal, just wanted to throw that in there, was like dogging Deion the entire series. And then when the Braves beat the Pirates, sorry, Alex,
okay.
he covered him in beer and champagne in the locker room. And then McCarver's standing there and he has this kind of hair like your boy has here, but it was like all hairsprayed up and shit. It like didn't move like my hair moves. And he dumps it on him and it's just, you see his hair melting and he just goes, nice move, Deion. Way to go, Deion. Real classy, Deion. Go look it up on YouTube. It's one of the greatest moments in Atlanta sports history because, like, one, we won, and two, fuck Tim McCarver.
Funny. Where'd you tell people to go look it up? Huh. The other thing is, like, that's the... Like, I think that Deion has found ways to be more than just a football player at every turn, whether it was track in high school and college, whether it was being a professional baseball player, right? It's even...
What a good one.
Right. Like, Michael Jordan couldn't make the White Sox.
Sucked.
Deion Sanders played in the World Series, right? Like, it was a different level here. You know, he has...
Dude, Michael Jordan, like, people... this is maybe another thing that you have to tell young kids. Like, Michael Jordan was a baseball player in so much as that he never made it out of Birmingham. I think it was AA, right?
Yeah. The Barons, Birmingham.
Like Barons. Deion was legit, dude. He was a fucking, he certainly was a threat as a fucking base stealer, and he was a great outfielder. And his bat was pretty solid, too.
Right. To the point, like, and he played for multiple teams. It wasn't just the Braves. He played for the Reds. Like, he ended his career playing for the Reds. So,
got traded to the Reds and then also played somewhere else. I can't remember.
So, it's, you know, he has always done these things that have been more, but what I, the point is, he's always had success doing them, right? And this may be the thing that you look back and you say it didn't have on field success at Colorado, but Whoa. the epitaph of it will be the different ways that we talk about and parse what this chunk of time he spent as a college football head coach ends up being.
I knew he played for the Giants. He did. He there was a season of the Giants. He had a his career WAR is 5.5.
That's wild.
I did not know that.
That's wild.
That's like a really good baseball player.